group continues to exist. It still has a lot of resources, a lot of capacity, a lot of money, and it has the ability to carry out catastrophic attacks.
He is talking about the resurgence of ISIS in the Sri Lanka attacks. This is Friday, April 26th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, the leaders of North Korea and Russia meet each other and eat dinner and talk, but apparently not much more. The former U.S. vice president now wants to lead the country in an attempt to convince more people to be vaccinated against disease. All on today's VO Asia. The U.S. Embassy in Colombo has advised people to avoid places of worship in Sri Lanka over the coming weekend, citing Sri Lankan reports that additional attacks may occur. The embassy said Thursday on its official Twitter account, continue to remain vigilant and avoid large crowds. The warning comes days after a devastating attack on Christian worshipers on Easter Sunday, when suicide bombers killed more than 250 people. Officials had earlier set the death toll at more than 350, but revised the number on Thursday, saying some of the bodies may have been counted twice. Sri Lanka's defense secretary quit Thursday in the wake of the bombings, heeding calls from Sri Lanka's president for his resignation. President Maithripala Sirisena had called for the resignation of both the defense secretary and the country's police chief, after he promised in a televised address to take stern action against officials who do not share with him the intelligence alerts that came from India days prior to the bombing of churches and luxury hotels. As the government faces an outpouring of public anger over the failure to heed these warnings, senior officials admit it has been a major lapse. Reports say Indian intelligence agencies sent out several warnings to Sri Lanka, and that Indian security agencies had gathered details about Islamic militant group National Tawhid Jamaat, or NTJ, which is suspected of carrying out the attacks. The government is also facing scrutiny over whether bitter political wrangling between Sirisena and the prime minister contributed to the failure to act upon warnings about the attacks. The prime minister said that there had been a breakdown in communication. Islamic State claimed responsibility for the bombings. That led to this conversation I had via Skype with Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. He said there's good reason to believe that ISIS was involved.
You know, the group that was identified as the perpetrator is a very small Islamist radical group that has been around for a few years, is extremist in its ideology and its thinking, but is very small and really has not done much other than, as I understand it, deface, spray paint a few Buddhist statues a few years ago after there had been some Buddhist mobs had attacked Muslims in Sri Lanka. So this is a group, it goes by the acronym NTJ. It does not have any type of capacity to stage an attack like what we saw. I mean, if what had happened on Sunday had simply been, you know, a guy throwing a grenade at a single church, then sure. I mean, you could argue that that would not need any type of support from the outside. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, several attacks staged in a coordinated fashion. There's no way that the small group could have done it. And the only outside group that would have the capacity and the desire, I would argue, at this point in time to help would be ISIS. It staged attacks very much like the one that we saw. It's gone after religious minorities. The attack really had all the hallmarks of ISIS. So I think that it definitely was involved.
How much has ISIS gone into South Asian countries?
Yeah, well, I mean, ISIS does have a footprint in South Asia. And I should say ISIS has a South Asia affiliate. It's called ISIS Khorasan, ISIS-K. It was formally established back in 2014. It's largely based in Afghanistan, particularly in eastern Afghanistan, and it has carried out attacks in Afghanistan in previous years. It also has a smaller presence in Pakistan. Very interestingly enough, it also has a footprint in Bangladesh. And in fact, you may remember a few years ago, there was this horrific attack on a bakery in Dhaka, Bangladesh, that was popular place for foreigners to go to. It killed several dozen people, including foreigners. That attack was carried out by a local group, a local Islamist group in Bangladesh, with cooperation from ISIS. So the model there was very similar to what seems to be emerging to be the case in Sri Lanka, where you have a local radical group essentially contracting with ISIS. ISIS essentially provides the probably a lot of money and organizational support and other things. So to answer your question, we had this attack in Sri Lanka, which is clearly the first attack that ISIS has ever been involved with in Sri Lanka. But they do have a presence, a longstanding presence in the broader region. And you talk about India, certainly ISIS has a modest, but nonetheless a real presence in India. There have been a number of ISIS members or sympathizers arrested there in recent years. This ISIS is—it's there. It's there in South Asia, and not just in South Asia. It's been involved in attacks in the Philippines and Indonesia as well.
So they have not been defeated. Is that correct?
No, not at all. Certainly, on a tactical level, it has been defeated in Syria and Iraq, where it's lost all the territory that it had controlled. But the group continues to exist. It still has a lot of resources, a lot of capacity, a lot of money. And it has the ability to carry out catastrophic attacks. And I think that will be the big thing to worry about, particularly with all of these fighters, these foreign fighters that had gone to Syria and Iraq to be a part of the caliphate, so to speak. Now that caliphate is destroyed, those foreign fighters that hadn't been killed, a lot of them have gone back to their home countries, including Sri Lanka. They've gone back to Europe. So I think one thing we really have to worry about looking forward is ISIS essentially looking to these returned fighters, trying to essentially take advantage of freedoms and access and open access in these Western democracies and staging attacks.
Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now at voanews.com. North Korea billed the United States $2 million for the medical care of a U.S. college student who was detained in Pyongyang in 2016 and returned to the United States comatose more than a year later, according to the Washington Post. The U.S. envoy negotiating with the Taliban in Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, says the answer to lowering the death toll in that country is to achieve a peace deal. China aims to make the Belt Road Initiative sustainable and prevent debt risk, its finance minister said on Thursday, seeking to allay criticism that the infrastructure plan to boost trade and investment creates a heavy burden for some nations. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and our website. VOA Asia continues. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he believes North Korean leader Kim Jong-un could give up his nuclear weapons if he first receives security guarantees. Putin made the comment Thursday after holding his first ever summit with Kim in the far eastern Russian city of Vladivostok. At a news conference following the talks, Putin also advocated a phased approach to denuclearization in which the United States and North Korea slowly take steps to build trust. According to Russia's state-run TASS news agency, that was quoted by them, Putin said, if we move step by step with respect for each other's interests, then this goal can be achieved in the final end. North Korea also prefers an incremental approach under which it would commit to giving up parts of its nuclear weapons as Washington gradually relaxes sanctions. U.S. President Donald Trump is seeking what he calls a big deal in which North Korea agrees to give up its entire nuclear program in exchange for normalized ties with the United States. Kim said very little during his meeting with Putin, which included nearly 2 hours of one-on-one meetings. It's not clear what security guarantees North Korea may demand in exchange for giving up its nuclear weapons. According to the Russian news agency, Putin said it is the international legal ones. In the past, North Korean officials have called on the United States to completely remove its strategic and nuclear-capable military assets from the region, which it views as a threat. VOA Russia correspondent Evgeny Baranov is in Vladivostok, and I spoke with him via Skype.
Kim Jong-un is trying to show to other actors that he still has some friends that he can, communicate with, and that's why he's trying to increase his importance. And this is also what Vladimir Putin is doing as well. This is the way how Putin tries to show that, to demonstrate that Russia is still relevant. Russia is still relevant for North Korea, and even though it may be not. This is what all about. It's all about like showing the world rather than doing the real things. If we look closely, we can see that Putin cannot provide anything really, really, as far as I see it. Putin cannot provide something really, really important and considerable for North Korea. So yeah, it's more about like demonstrations and symbols and showing some things to other actors.
As far as the news value of this, beyond what you just said, what is the headline from this? Is there any hard news headline that has come from this?
Putin just said that we discussed denuclearization. We discussed denuclearization, and it was also mentioned that we mentioned a six-party talks, which was an absolute failure. But this is actually the most important thing, that both sides, they touch upon the denuclearization things, and they confirm that they would love to work on this topic, which means it's something a way more different that was happened in Hanoi, when there was no any chance, as it turned out, as a result of the summit, for any denuclearization progress. But here we can see that the major thing is that Russia demonstrates that it is ready to contribute to denuclearization process, to the negotiation process. And this is the same thing that Kim Jong-un did as well. So this is it.
So it's all over now, is that correct?
It is over. So the thing that Putin, he has gone his departure to Beijing for the International Forum, where he probably is going to meet with Xi Jinping and also discuss the topics that were covered during his meeting with Kim Jong-un. But the interesting thing is that I never mentioned this before, but North Korean leaders, he stayed in Vladivostok for 2 days more. So Putin, he actually left Kim Jong-un alone in the city of Vladivostok, which is not really common situation on international arena, as far as I can understand, because maybe it's also there is some meaning in this. Maybe Putin can just show, you know, the hierarchy in the relations, or maybe it's just the schedule of Vladimir Putin. Maybe there is no any like, you know, special message about this.
Was this an effort, as you see it, to isolate the United States?
I would say that it's nothing about isolation, but it's about pushing the United States to soften its agenda, to soften its position, because Russia, it does not have much capacity to really, let's say, to really deal with a nuclear problem on Korean Peninsula. But the United States are the countries that can do it, and Russia cannot do it alone with North Korea. But so nobody wants an isolation of the United States, but everybody, North Korea and Russia, wants United States to change its position. And this is what all the summit is about.
VOA Russia correspondent Evgeny Baranov in Vladivostok. Happening now in Asia, Pakistan says it is highly dismayed at the recent surge in hostilities in Afghanistan from all sides, warning it would harm ongoing efforts to bring peace to the war-ravaged neighboring country. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us. Former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden made it official Thursday. He is a candidate for president in 2020. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more.
We are in the battle for the soul of this nation.
Joe Biden officially entered the 2020 campaign with an online video targeting President Donald Trump.
But if we give Donald Trump 8 years in the White House, he will forever and fundamentally alter the character of this nation, who we are, and I cannot stand by and watch that happen.
Biden paid particular attention to Trump's widely condemned remarks following the violent clash between white supremacists and counter-protesters in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. The president said there were, in his words, very fine people on both sides. Just last month, members of a firefighters union urged Biden to get into the race during his speech in Washington.
There is no quit in America. There never has been, and there never will be because of you.
Biden begins his third presidential quest as a slight favorite, says analyst Jim Kessler.
He's a front runner. He's not a super strong front runner the way Hillary Clinton was, where it felt like this is kind of wrapped up from the start. But I do think he's a legitimate front runner. There is genuine affection for him out there. People do think he could beat Donald Trump.
Biden faces a large Democratic field with several women and minority candidates looking to build support from a young and diverse voter base, says expert Matt Dalek.
The field is so sprawling, and it's so such an interesting and dynamic field that with many, frankly, very strong candidates, you know, any of whom could theoretically and really plausibly rise to the top.
Biden came under fire recently from several women who said his intimate personal style made them uncomfortable, and he vowed to be more mindful in the future.
And I'll be much more mindful. That's my responsibility.
Many Democrats see Biden as a moderate, and he's counting on his tenure as former President Barack Obama's vice president to win over progressive activists.
You know, everybody asks, you know, what kind of Democrat? I'm an Obama-Biden Democrat, man. I'm proud of it.
Biden's frontrunner status will make him a target, says Jim Kessler.
He will immediately face a lot of attacks because he is the candidate that people feel like, other candidates feel like, I need to bring him down in order to have a chance.
President Trump welcomed Biden to the race with a tweet addressed to Sleepy Joe. Biden is 76, and his age and long record as a senator from the state of Delaware could be an issue, says analyst Bill Sweeney.
Campaigns are about tomorrow. They're not about yesterday. And Democrats, as long as they stay focused on tomorrow, will win.
At the outset, Biden's strategy appears to be convincing Democrats that he is the best candidate to take on and defeat President Trump next year. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Police in Pakistan say unknown gunmen shot dead a female polio vaccinator and wounded another Thursday, raising the number of deaths to three in attacks against this week's national immunization campaign. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. Let's talk about World Immunization Week, recognized during the last week in April, encouraging people to get vaccinated to protect against infectious diseases. This year, as the number of reported measles cases in the U.S. increases, public health officials are facing pushback from some who fear vaccines that could be dangerous. VOA's Elizabeth Chernoff has more.
Who has the right to decide who should and should not be vaccinated? In the United States, most schools require students to be vaccinated, but there are exemptions to the rule.
Carol Pearson, VOA health reporter.
There are medical reasons. Anybody who would be allergic to these vaccines needs to be exempted. Then there are religious reasons. A very small number of religions prevent their children from being vaccinated.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports more than 600 cases of measles in the U.S. so far this year. That's the second highest total since 2000, the year many experts thought measles was eradicated nationwide. The viral infection causes fever and rash and can have serious complications, including pneumonia, deafness, and even death. In some communities, immunization has sparked discussions between parents and children, like in the case of Ohio teenager Ethan Lindenberger. In March, the 18-year-old testified before Congress about his decision to get vaccinated against his mother's wishes. He hopes sharing his family's experience will help others in similar situations.
She talked openly about these beliefs. I'd argue with her about these, and I'd be confused. I would have questions, and they really weren't answered. And so I turned 18, and soon after that, I called her and said, hey, I'm going to do this, and I really hope you understand. Explained why I was going to do it. And, you know, even though there were some arguments and there was some frustration and fear, I knew what I was doing was important. And that's what kind of pushed me to continue it.
Concerns about side effects aren't new, but experts say digital media helps spread misinformation.
Dr. Lisa Fitzpatrick, epidemiologist.
I've had personal experiences with people who homeschool their children telling me as a physician they wouldn't vaccinate their children because they didn't believe and the safety. But we didn't hear about this as much because they didn't have social media to spread the messages.
Despite the controversy, vaccine rates in the U.S. are still high. A CDC study found that 94% of children in the U.S. received the first dose of vaccines that protect against measles, mumps, rubella, and other vaccine-preventable diseases. Elizabeth Cherna, VOA News, Washington.
This news alert from VOA Asia. The Malaysian climber stranded in the open for two nights on one of the world's most treacherous mountains was rescued in Nepal Thursday, according to expedition organizers. Climbing experts say it was a miracle that 48-year-old Chinwee Kin survived the freezing conditions on Mount Annapurna for so long. You are listening to VOA Asia. Thanks for being with us. The awesome power of nature remains undefeated. Arash Arabasadi explains.
Along the coastline of the Isle of Wight, new research shows that even nature's defenses may not protect against her wrath.
You know, this is a natural defense, if you like, to the land that lies behind it. And as this area erodes with the removal of these large blocks, that also then increases potentially the hazards that will be impacted on the land behind us here.
For the past 3 years, researchers at the University of Portsmouth in England tracked boulder movement using radio technology they embedded into more than 100 stones. They say the results were surprising.
As an example, you know, we've got this really large boulder, 10-ton boulder, probably, you know, the weight of four or five family cars, that has been moved some 10 meters from the edge of the shore platform there. Which is quite remarkable, really, when you consider the wave climate here being relatively sheltered. We're still seeing the movement of really large stuff, perhaps more so than we're seeing the smaller stuff move.
Researchers say their work is more than just boulders on the beach. Their findings may shine an ominous light on the future of the world's coastal communities.
We see, obviously, with the onset of climate change, we're going to see bigger storms, more frequent storms, and ultimately there'll be more damage as a result of that. And so if we have a better understanding of how our coastlines are responding to present-day storm activity, we can get a better idea of what we anticipate might happen in the future.
Portsmouth's research team says their findings show an increase in potential hazards in coastal communities. They say erosion at the coast threatens the land behind it, which may support infrastructure for schools, roads, businesses, and homes. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast. Take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com and let's hear from you at VOA Asia Facebook and our email at voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineers, Dinab Abdul Rahman, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day.